The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Brad McDonald, and I'll be your host for today's program. We have another beautiful day here in England in the Warwickshire countryside. Today, everyone's a little tired after a busy weekend. We had combined services on Saturday. Yesterday, we had a lot of graduation festivities. It was just really a wonderful day yesterday. We were able to connect to headquarters and watch the graduation of 2-year and 4-year grads from Armstrong College yesterday evening. During the day, we had a barbecue where we had some family members of graduates and the employees, and it really was just a really fun time. And we played a game of American football, which was a lot of fun. It really is easy living here in the UK countryside, which is just so peaceful, so beautiful, especially at this time of the year. And it's fairly safe too. And our neighbors are friendly, and Stratford-upon-Avon and Henley and Arden, some of the towns that are our local towns really are the quintessential English village, just real peaceful and quiet. And it really is beautiful. And it's so easy sometimes living in such an environment. And a lot of people around the world live in environments like this. Over there at headquarters in Edmond. Edmond is still just a beautiful suburb of Oklahoma City. Very peaceful, very quiet. Up there on the campus, it's just beautiful and peaceful and quiet. It really is easy living in these environments to maybe develop a bit of a false sense of security sometimes. It's important that we are watching this world, because it's only by watching this world that we can really respond to all of the crises, that we can respond to all of the alarming events and trends, that we can respond to the trouble the way that God wants us to. There's just, as I mentioned, there's still quite a few places in this world that if you don't turn on the news, or if you don't look at Twitter, or if you don't go on the internet, then, and if you just look at your immediate environment, then you can really just kind of be lulled into sleep, thinking that everything in this world is okay, that everything in this world is stable, and that, well, mankind has got everything under control. And that's just not the case. That's not the case. And for those of us who at this moment in time are blessed to live in relative tranquility, the onus is on us to watch and pray, as Christ said in Luke 21, to really stay in tune with what's happening in the world. And that's what I wanted to do today, is just go through three separate events that are happening that really do just show that this world is not nearly as stable as it can be easy to believe, depending on where we live. The first news event I wanted to get into was the presidential elections that occurred in Austria over the weekend. Now, the final results of these elections aren't in yet. I think they'll be tallied today. But right now, it looks like that the Austria's presidential election will be won by a far-right candidate. His name is Norbert Hofer. He's the leader of the Freedom Party in Austria. The Freedom Party is a far-right party, or a right-wing party, an ultra-conservative party. Some of the forefathers of Austria's Freedom Party were Nazis. One was an SS officer. It stands for all of those right-wing values and ideologies. It's anti-immigrant. It's strongly nationalist. It's Eurosceptic. But it looks like the Freedom Party's candidate will become Austria's next president. And this is really a big deal. This is the first time a political party, or a first time a far-right political party, will actually be in office, holding an office, a political office in Europe. I'll just read a couple of quotes here. This first quote comes from The Telegraph today. And the author is Peter Foster. He writes, "So, Austria today stands within a whisker of becoming the first country in the history of the European Union to elect a far-right president in the shape of Norbert Hofer, a softly spoken but deeply ideological candidate from Austria's Freedom Party." And then he says, "A Hofer win wouldn't plunge Austria or Europe into the Dark Ages or bring Nazis back on the streets of Vienna, at least not in large numbers. But it would be a hugely symbolic moment for the potential power of Europe's populist parties." And it would, the point he's making is that it would be indicative of a trend that is taking place in multiple European countries, that is the rise of populist parties, and most of them are these far-right parties. There is a trend in Europe toward nationalist political parties, or political parties that have a staunchly against immigration and even the European Union. Peter Foster was talking to the leader of the Freedom Party in the Netherlands, Geert Wilders. And Wilders, he's the Dutch politician. He looks a little bit like Donald Trump, I suppose. At least his hair does. He's got this big golden mane. And he's been around for years. He's probably, he's probably a founding member of the contemporary radical or right-wing movement here in Europe. But he was commenting to Peter about the success of Austria's right-wing president, or soon-to-be president. And Wilders said that a Hofer victory would provide an enormous incentive for populist parties all over Europe to actually believe they can win. It would show that, quote, "we are not parties on the fringe of politics, that we are not only the biggest party in respective countries, but that we can even provide the head of state." So they don't just have, a good number of seats in parliament, but they can actually furnish the head of state. That's what looks like is about to happen in Austria. Just keeping on reading this quote from The Telegraph. "But as Mr. Hofer told a jubilant election rally in Vienna on Saturday night, the reality is that win or lose the presidency, the Freedom Party had already won by winning the votes of 50% of Austrians." Now, that really is pretty remarkable. Here's a far-right party winning 50% of the votes. 50%. The Telegraph continues, "It's a symbol of the change now sweeping the continent that in 2016, neither of the two main parties even managed to get a candidate in to the second round runoff." So the two, I forget the name of the two mainstream parties in Austria that have just dominated Austrian politics since World War II. One is a socialist party, I forget the other. But, they didn't even garner enough votes to participate in a second round runoff. They didn't even make it to the second round. The Freedom Party won 50% of the votes, and it looks like Norbert Hofer is going to become the president of Austria over the next couple of days. Just keeping on with this article from The Telegraph, "The message on the stump is often both crude and contradictory, but in one respect, crystal clear. From America to Austria, from Athens to Amsterdam, the ordinary Joe and Joanna is deeply angry and frustrated at the failure of the existing order to deliver, except unto themselves." He's just making the point that what's happening in Austria isn't confined to Austria, that this trend is happening all across Europe and even in the United States. And he's referring, obviously, to the rise of Donald Trump. The Freedom Party, Hofer's party, is nationalistic, nostalgic, and deeply divisive. Mr. Hofer has been instrumental in reclaiming the party for the pan-German ideology that was dropped by the late Freedom Party late leader Jörg Haider's brand of populism. That's an interesting ideology that Hofer apparently subscribes to. He subscribes to this ideology of pan-Germanism. This is a belief that all of the German-speaking populations of Europe are one, and that they should be united into a greater Germany. Hofer has, well, he's made statements, but there's also been some acts that indicate that's a core belief of his, that all of the different populations in Europe that speak German should be united into one greater Germany. This is the concept of pan-Germanism. It's been around for the past 200 years, pan-Germanism. It really emerged, I guess you would call it an ideology. It emerged as an ideology in the 19th century when all of the German duchies and kingdoms came together into one nation. It was a key part of the ambition behind German leaders in World War I. They wanted to create a German empire in Europe. They wanted to bring all of the different German-speaking peoples into the German Empire. And obviously, Adolf Hitler, too, was a staunch believer in pan-Germanism. This was why in the 1930s, I think it's called the Anschluss in Austria. He went down to Austria and he said, okay, you know, you speak German, you belong to Germany, we've got all this history together, come join us. He took over the Sudetenland, which was basically this part of Czechoslovakia that was comprised of German speakers. This is kind of off the top of my head here, but Richard Palmer is the technical editor today, and he's agreeing with me. And then I forget the region, but it's that region in eastern France that's along the border with Germany. Hitler went in there too, and he said, okay, you people speak German. You're now part of the pan-Germany. You're now part of the German Empire, which I'm creating. But this pan-Germanism, this ideology of pan-Germanism, is at least in its origins, and for many who believe it, it's racist. You know, at the foundation of it is this belief in a master race. So that is what Austria's new president believes in. And Jörg Haider was the leader of the Freedom Party in Austria in the 1980s. And he was a nationalist, but he was a nationalist in the sense that he believed Austria should be a strong sovereign country, and he believed in, you know, Austrians as a people. The Freedom Party, I mean, I don't think Hofer is suggesting Austria should no longer be a sovereign nation. He's not. But he absolutely sees Austria as part of the German Empire. So that's just an interesting belief that he holds. Just a couple of final remarks here. I'll just read a few quotes from The Guardian talking about Norbert Hofer, Austria's most likely next president. This was from Friday. This is from The Guardian, so we have to remember who it's coming from. It's coming from a pretty left-wing source, and they may make some good points in here, but usually they will exaggerate them. The man who could on Sunday become Austria's first right-wing populist president likes to present himself as a centrist. The Austrian Freedom Party's Norbert Hofer argued in a recent interview that he was far from right-wing, but to the left of the US Democrats. Then a little further on down it says, but a number of commentators warn that Hofer's persuasive oratory and natural charm have allowed him to successfully cover up an ideological background that places him on the extreme right of the political spectrum. Then it quotes one Freedom Party member, a member of Hofer's own party, who described Hofer, to quote, as a sheep in wolf's clothing, a ticking time bomb. Then it provides some details about his background. Hofer was tasked with rewriting the Freedom Party's manifesto in 2011, reintroducing a commitment to the German people and a cultural community. He used a German phrase which strongly echoes the rhetoric of the Nazi era. So this is interesting. It would be interesting if this trend developed in other countries, maybe adjacent to Germany. But here's a man who's about to become Austria's next president, and he views Austria, he views it as a sovereign country, but he views it as part of a German empire. That's just interesting. Critics point out that Hofer's actions send a different message. He is an honorary member of the student fraternity Marco Germania Pinkerfeld, which in its 1994 founding document rejects the history-defying fiction of an Austrian nation. Again, he believes Austria is part of a greater German empire. And then it just lists some of the other acts that Hofer has done that suggest that he identifies with this pan-German ideology. Now, just back to the point that is being made that Hofer is just part of a larger trend unfolding in Europe. I'll read this, another quote from the Telegraph. This was from last week. And it says, "It is a paradox, given the unmatched scale of the horrors inflicted on Europe by Nazi Germany, that one of the most enduring weapons in the fight against fascism and the far right has been never to take them too seriously." So the approach, the mainstream approach to far right segments in Europe has, for the past, you know, since World War II, has been, well, if we just ignore them, they'll go away. If we don't give them any attention, they'll remain as kind of these marginal political parties that no one really takes seriously. The Telegraph article continues, "Over the last 70 years, these methods have been sufficient to ensure that the political center holds. But all across Europe, there are now an increasing number of reasons to fear that that is no longer the case." And the point they make is, well, we can't ignore, you know, this policy of just marginalizing far-right political parties by ignoring them, well, we can't do that any longer. They're just becoming too popular. "The toxic combination of the most prolonged period of economic stagnation and the worst refugee crisis since the end of the Second World War has seen the far right surging across the country, from Athens to Amsterdam and many points in between. The parties may be fronted with softer faces these days, but their underlying ideology of xenophobia and nationalism remain unchanged." So this is an alarming trend that we're seeing increasingly in Europe, is the rise of far-right parties. Now, again, let's say from a human perspective, you can understand why some of these parties would be growing more popular. And you know, this is really not an attack on, let's say, most of the individuals that would support Austria's Freedom Party or Geert Wilders or France's, I think it's the Le Pen in France. I mean, I don't want to seem like I'm attacking supporters of those parties. I understand their concerns. It's understandable why they would be, you know, why people in Austria, why 50% of Austrians would be concerned about immigrants. I think Austria took in 80 or 90,000 immigrants last year. I go to Vienna quite often, and I have friends down there, and they come in, you know, one or two of them come in and to Vienna via train, and they talk about, you know, we were having dinner a couple of months ago, and the man had to go back to catch the train back to Salzburg, and you know, the train station is just full of immigrants. You can understand why growing numbers of Austrians are concerned about mostly Muslim immigrants moving into their city and expecting, aid from the government. Their concerns are understandable. And they're flocking to, in Austria's case, they're flocking to Hofer and the Freedom Party. So, you know, the rise of the far right is an understandable trend, but it is also pretty alarming because a lot of these parties, well, first of all, if you trace their history in quite a few cases, you can trace the in the case of the Freedom Party in Austria, you can trace their history right back to the Nazi Party, the National Socialists that were around in the 1930s and in the 1940s. And then in many cases, you know, think the Golden Dawn in Greece or Jobbik in, I think that's Hungary. You know, in many cases, these far-right parties really do support some pretty extreme solutions to problems like the migrant crisis. So, but on the other hand, if you're living in Austria or if you're living in Hungary, if you're living in Germany, and if you're concerned about the unchecked inflow of migrants, what do you do? Who do you talk to? What political party is going to ensure your safety? So it is an alarming trend, the rise of right-wing political parties throughout Europe, and it's certainly one that we need to keep an eye on. Just one last point that was interesting about Norbert Hofer, the leader of Austria's Freedom Party and probably the next president of Austria. Apparently, and this, when I read this, I was a little surprised because this is not the quintessential European adornment. But he likes to carry a Glock 9mm pistol. Apparently he has a license and he carries a pistol with him. He says carrying guns is, quote, a natural consequence of immigration. And he likes to post pictures of him and his family on gun ranges. Again, you know, in America, that's not uncommon. A politician, especially if he's a Republican or running on the Republican ticket, he almost needs to put out a few photos of him holding a gun to appeal to the voters. But here in Europe, you don't see too many politicians running around with handguns on their hips. But this man does. Just a couple of the Telegraph asked the question. So is he really a Nazi in disguise? And then it answers, depends who you talk to. Hofer was responsible for drafting the new Freedom Party manifesto, which has taken the party back to its nationalist roots, focusing on identity. That's code for native Austrians, not immigrants or their children. He has also been spotted wearing the blue cornflower, which is an old clandestine Nazi symbol that harks back to the ideas of pan-Germanism, the 19th century idea of a greater Germany that ultimately inspired Hitler's foreign policy and the annexations and invasions that triggered the Second World War. So his love of Germany and the concept of a pan-German empire, that certainly makes Hofer an even more interesting individual to watch. If he believes that, and it really looks like he does, and if he, you know, is an influential voice in Austria, it's very easy to see him getting on board very quickly with what Germany might want to do in the future. Okay, we can. That's enough of talking about Hofer and Austria. Let's just move now to Germany. And I just wanted to read a few quotes from a report that was recently produced by George Friedman at Geopolitical Futures. And the title of this report, you can get it if you like online. It's pretty easy to find. The title of the report is Germany's Invisible Crisis and How the World Should See It. Now, there's a lot of detail in here and a lot of intellectual analysis. But the essence of this report is that, or the point that Friedman makes in general, is that Germany is the fourth largest exporter in the world. Germany's economy is an export-driven economy, and when exports are high, then Germany and Germany's economy does great and the people are happy. But if exports drop, global markets grow unhealthy, if America and China and those countries that Germany exports to, if their economies fail, then Germany's exports decline. And if Germany's exports decline, then unemployment goes up, tax income for the government goes down, and it can really lead to a massive economic crisis. And that is what he suggests will happen over the next year or two. I can just read a few high points if you like. Given the enormous size of the German economy, the country must export vast amounts every year to maintain social and political stability. Prosperity for exporters depends on the appetites of their customers, and since 2008, their ability to rely on exports has been diminishing. While other major exporters have been struggling, Germany has actually increased its export levels. Germany has thus created a significant vulnerability for itself and will be the next country to face an export crisis. Given the country's high dependence on exports, this crisis will likely be extreme and destabilizing, with negative implications for other European countries. One interesting fact here that he makes is that Germany derives about 45% of its GDP from exports. That's really pretty remarkable. Almost half of Germany's GDP, and I forget what the figure is for that, but almost half of Germany's GDP comes from exporting goods. And the question Friedman raises here is, well, what does Germany do if its exports drop? Which he says is inevitable, because the global economy the economies of the nations that Germany is exporting to are not healthy. And exports will inevitably drop. So what happens then? A little further on down, he says, Germany appears on the surface to have weathered the crisis well to this point. However, in our view, Germany's growth model will not help the country avoid a crisis for much longer. The strategies Germany has used to maintain high export rates are unsustainable. So he says that a massive crisis is coming. I'll just read a couple of quotes from the conclusion of this report. It appears that the problem of contracting exports is being postponed rather than solved. Germany's high dependence on exports causes the German state, bankers, and corporations to want to avoid export decline for as long as possible. In the report, he shows how German corporations and German manufacturers, you know, they're reducing the selling price of their products so that they can keep exports high. You know, the government is helping out by enacting some policies, but what's happening is German corporations, you know, they're really getting creative with ways to keep their exports levels up. You know, they're dropping prices so markets will continue to put orders in for their goods. But that's not sustainable. At some point, Germany's exports are going to go down. Just continuing with the conclusion here. Since exports are over 45% of Germany's GDP, a 5% drop would result in a decline in GDP of more than 2%, which would have a staggering impact. One of the first things it would do is cause, you know, a lot more unemployment. I think Germany's unemployment rate is about 4%, 4.5%. It's very low. It's quite impressive. But, you know, if it can't keep exporting goods to the rest of the world, then the factories, and boy, when you drive around Germany, you can see, you know, with your own eyes, you can see evidence that Germany is an export-driven economy. There are just factories everywhere. And if some of these factories have to start laying off employees, unemployment's going to go up. And then you think, too, about Germany. While times have been good, Germany's actually had a bit of an employment crisis in the sense that it hasn't had enough employees. And the solution for the past 10 or 15 years has been, well, let's bring up, you know, people from Turkey and they can work in our factories. Let's bring in immigrants so that they can help us out. But what happens now if native Germans have to start being laid off? And what happens if jobs are scarce in Germany? And then we have all of these migrants who are looking for jobs. And we have native Germans competing with some of these migrants for work. Well, that's really not going to help the anti-migrant sense or the anti-migrant frustrations that are intense already in Germany. I mean, you could easily see this ballooning very quickly into a massive social and political crisis. Friedman continues, therefore, the Germans are postponing this decline for as long as possible. However, delaying it compounds the problems in the long run, particularly for already weak German banks that may be forced to deal with delayed or restructured debt payments. The Germans are facing a profound financial crisis that can be postponed but not avoided. The world's economy is stagnating and exporters around the world are seeing declines. Germany has not so far. When it does, which is inevitable, the fourth largest economy in the world will suddenly see massive export contractions, declines in GDP, and a significant financial crisis with global implications. And you can add to that if there's a significant financial crisis, then there's going to be significant political and social crisis. And I think just as we talk about elections occurring across Europe and political crises, I think Germany's national elections are next May or June next year, 2017. So Germany is moving toward less than a year now until we see German national elections. And with the migrant crisis, with the threats hanging over the economy, with the rise of far-right political parties, you can already see that this is going to be a really interesting election in Germany next year. Okay, let's go ahead, Richard, and we'll take a break and then come back after the break and talk about one last really important news subject.
The Trumpet Daily.
Westminster Abbey in London, England, holds the bones of men and women who have ruled from the British throne. It serves as a memorial to the British belief that a good king or queen can only be made through understanding the history of the throne. But do the British peoples even remember that history? What is the real significance of that throne? Many wonder why the British people cling so strongly to the throne. The long-standing monarchy has run its course throughout their national history and remains to this day. But where did it all begin? The awe-inspiring truth is that the monarchy in Britain traces its roots all the way back to King David of Israel. A simple examination of the coronations of kings in the Bible reveals striking similarities found today in Britain's coronations. Every king and queen is crowned while sitting over the stone of destiny. The ceremony occurs near the altar. The anointing ceremony. The roar of the people shouting, "God save the queen." All this inspiring history can be found in your Bible. God promised King David that his throne would endure for all time, unconditionally. This throne is found today in Britain. The same throne will soon serve as the place from which Christ will govern the entire earth. And it all starts with a proper understanding of the significance of this royal throne. This incredible truth is discussed in depth in our book, The Key of David. Visit thetrumpet.com to read it online or to request your copy today.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily. I'm Brad McDonald, your host for today. For the final news item that I thought we could take a look at, we're going to turn to an article printed today by The Washington Post. The title of the article is Primed to Fight the Government. And the quip says, a fast-growing U.S. movement armed with guns and the Constitution sees a dire threat to liberty. Now, the article really makes some interesting points. I think it exposes a really alarming trend that we're seeing in America. There are quite a few things I don't like about the article. The Washington Post is pretty liberal, and they really paint some of the individuals that they focus on as you know, just kind of being crazy and outlandish and even dangerous to America. But it does put the spotlight on just a pretty alarming trend that is unfolding in the United States. I'll just go through and read parts of this article. It starts off, the author is spending some time with a man called BJ Sopa and BJ's family up in Oregon, I believe it is. BJ Sopa took aim with his AR-15 semi-automatic rifle and fired a dozen shots at a human silhouette target. Sopa's wife and their 16-year-old daughter practiced drawing pistols. Then Sopa helped his 4-year-old daughter in pink sneakers and a ponytail work on her marksmanship with a .22 caliber rifle. Deep in the heart of a vast U.S. military training ground, surrounded by spent shotgun shells and juniper trees, the Central Oregon Constitutional Guard was conducting its weekly firearms training. And basically, the entire article is about the rise in America of groups, militia-type groups, who are arming themselves and they're preparing for conflict with the federal government. The article continues. Those in the movement, this is the Central Oregon Constitutional Guard, those in the movement call themselves patriots. See, it's that kind of terminology that has to raise a question mark when you read it. They call themselves patriots. Well, maybe they are patriots. Maybe they are patriots. But it says, those in the movement call themselves patriots, demanding that the federal government adhere to the Constitution and stop what they see as systematic abuse of land rights, gun rights, freedom of speech, and other liberties. Again, what they see as systematic abuse. Well, it's not just what they see, it's what is actually happening. It's what the facts reveal. Law enforcement officials call them dangerous, delusional, and sometimes violent, talking about these organizations or these groups that are rising up and preparing for conflict with the federal government. Law enforcement officials call them dangerous, delusional, and sometimes violent, and say that their numbers are growing amid a wave of anger at the government that has been gaining strength since 2008. A surge that coincided with the election of the first U.S. black president and a crippling economic recession. I think if you read between the lines, what they're saying is, you know, that these movements are racist. Sopa started his group, which consists of about 30 men, women, and children. From different backgrounds, to fight against, quote, all enemies, foreign and domestic. Mainly, he's talking about the federal government, which he thinks is capable of unprovoked aggression against its own people. The group's members are drywallers, flooring contractors, nurses and painters, and high school students who stockpile supplies, practice survival skills, and basic infantry tactics, learn how to treat combat injuries, study the Constitution, and train with their concealed handguns and combat-style rifles. This is pretty remarkable. These kinds of movements or organizations like this are popping up all over the United States. That's what this article, that's one of the points this article makes. A bit further on down, it continues. Law enforcement officials and watchdog groups that track the self-styled patriot groups, call them anti-government extremists, militias, armed militants, or even domestic terrorists. Some opponents of the largely white and rural groups have made fun of them, calling them Y'al Qaeda, or Vanilla ISIS. Mark Patok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors extremism, said that there were about 150 such groups in 2008, and today there are about 1,000. Potok and other analysts, including law enforcement officials who track the groups, said their supporters number in the hundreds of thousands. So there's more than 1,000 groups like this who are arming themselves. They're buying weapons. They're engaging in training. They're learning how to administer field medicine when people get shot. Just going back to this this man Soper's group, the article continues, everyone in the group keeps 30 days worth of food and emergency supplies on hand. Group members learn gardening and raising livestock. They go camping and learn survival tactics, including how to fashion a shelter, find food and water, and make a fire. McNeely and Lisa Soper are taking emergency medical technician class to learn to treat wounds, including combat trauma. They are all working on getting ham radio licenses to communicate in the event that the cell phone network fails. Isn't that remarkable? There's more than 1,000 groups across America like this. These people that are actually going out and they're getting training. They're learning how to treat leg wounds and open wounds. They're learning, they're going to school to learn all of those basic techniques. They're learning how to grow their own food. They're raising livestock. I mean, it's if they're preparing, and some say that they are, they're preparing for the world to end. They're preparing for complete anarchy in America. They're preparing for the time when there's no electricity, when there's no law enforcement, when there's no internet, when there's no cell phones. These people believe that time is coming, and they want to be in a position to where they can survive that. This is 21st century America. This is 21st century America. This is where the greatest nation in history is at today. Continuing of this article, but a bedrock of their mission is to be an armed and trained paramilitary force. Soper said group members train on basic infantry skills, quote, working a patrol, patrolling with a vehicle, arriving at contact, and how to protect yourself and escape from that. We are not soldiers, Soper said, but we know the basics. And then a couple paragraphs down, the author quotes again this man, Soper. I don't know that it's all that far-fetched that we have an economic collapse, he said. The dollar is a pretty scary investment right now. China's buying up all the gold. When people get hungry and thirsty and can't feed themselves, they get desperate. So this group and hundreds of groups like them, they're preparing for that time. They're preparing for complete and total chaos in the United States. And they're preparing, too, to be attacked by the federal government. The last thing I want is violence, Soper said. But I hope they see, talking about law enforcement and the federal government, but I hope they see that if we continue down this path, we're going to have more bloodshed in this country. It's really a pretty frightening picture, isn't it? And you know he's right. He's right. Because on the other side, there's also a large group of people on the other side who say, we want anarchy. We want violence. Soper kept typing, warning that the government had lost common sense. And then it quotes, he's writing an email, I guess, to his local sheriff. I pray we find some sense of it again. Otherwise, a very dark future awaits us, and it is not very far down the road. Sheriff, he said, people are going to die. So we're seeing this across America, groups like this, coming together, buying weapons, stockpiling food, engaging in training, learning how to treat wounds, preparing for complete and total social breakdown, violence, and chaos. This is 21st century America. This month, OpenTheBooks.com released a report. This is a report that was released just here in May. And the title of the report is The Militarization of Local Police Departments. So we just read an article making the point that there are hundreds of groups, militia-type groups, preparing themselves for violence. Well, what about the federal government? What does it think on this issue? Well, this report goes through and it just it highlights the federal government and how much military hardware it has been giving to state and local governments. The report in the introduction starts, "It's no secret the American people are distrustful of our political class, and rightly so. One area of federal spending that raises troubling questions on both sides of the political divide is the transfer of surplus Department of Defense equipment to local police departments under the 1033 program created by the National Defense Authorization Act." And then it goes through, over the past 2 years, more than $2 billion worth of military gear has been given to state and local police forces. It's remarkable. Just a few high points from this study. And in total, our new data reveals $2.2 billion worth of military gear, including helicopters and airplanes, armored trucks and cars, tens of thousands of M16 and M14 rifles, thousands of bayonets, mine detectors, and other types of weaponry have been given to local police forces. And then it has a search engine here to where you can type in your zip code and it'll show what your local police department received from the federal government. I actually typed it in for Edmond, Oklahoma, and I've got a long list here. I was going to go through and show some of these items. You know, a major military truck worth $60,000, thousands of magazine cartridges, bayonet knives, another truck. I mean, there's probably, I don't know, 400 or 500 items on this list. And then with some items, there's multiple quantities. In California, we found 18,794 Department of Defense transactions transferring weaponry, including nearly 7,500 trades involving M16 and M14 rifles. This is the federal government just giving state and local governments all of these weapons. The University of California and at Berkeley accepted the delivery of 14 M16 and M14 rifles. The University of California? Why would a university need these high-powered military-grade weapons? It doesn't make sense. Yet that paled in comparison to the 1,105 M16 and M14 rifles and two mine-resistant vehicles acquired by the Los Angeles County Sheriff. In Florida, the State Highway Patrol received 1,795 M16 and M14 rifles, plus six military armored vehicles, three mine-resistant vehicles, and three complete combat assault tactical wheeled vehicles. In Washington, D.C., the Metropolitan Police Department procured 500 M16 rifles. The Metro Transit Police have also followed a federal procurement process to obtain 134 pounds of C4, TNT, potassium chlorate, Semtex, and other explosives. The logic behind it is that, you know, drug cartels are running rampant in America. Criminals are using, you know, higher powered weapons. And, you know, well, we've got to arm local police forces so that they can, you know, they can deal with these kind of criminals. But it's really pretty frightening. $2.2 billion worth of high-tech, high-powered military hardware being sold to your local police or finding its way to your local police station. Why is that? Is the federal government, you know, expecting more violence, more chaos? Well, there's no doubt about that, is there? There's absolutely no doubt about that. When you look at what's happening in America and the level of hatred and the level of tension and animosity and bitterness and agitating going on between the races and between political parties and between age groups and cultures, some really frightening events are about to happen in that country. I just wanted to conclude by reading a few quotes from an article that our Trumpet editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, wrote last year. The title of the article is "Your Cities Are Burned with Fire." And in that article, he explains the prophecies in Isaiah chapter 1, where God says that your cities, the cities of the nations of Israel, are burned with fire. Just read a few quotes from this article. You can find this at thetrumpet.com. But Mr. Flory goes through these scriptures. He shows that God is very clearly talking to the nations of Israel, America and Britain today. But Mr. Flory writes, "Look now at this lightning bolt prophecy, explaining the terrible consequences of our grave national sins." Then he quotes verse 7 of Isaiah 1. "Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devour it in your presence. And it is desolate and overthrown by strangers." This prophecy is a guarantee that our national problems are going to get worse if we don't listen to God, Mr. Flory writes. He is pleading with us to hear his message, to listen to him, and to fear him. When are we going to do that? When are we going to listen to God? When are you going to listen to God? God is trying to help us see that something is frighteningly wrong. He says, "Don't point fingers at the leaders because you're all to blame." This is not a smooth message, but it's the truth. God blames us all. We are trying to solve these problems our way, and it simply cannot be done. You know, now maybe 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, you could read Isaiah's prophecy about mass social unrest, our cities burning as a result of civil war. And maybe 40 or 50 years ago, that would seem absurd, you know, that there weren't any facts to back that up. But look at all the facts now. Look at all the facts that show that prophecy is about to be fulfilled. More than 1,000 groups around America arming themselves, coming together and training for conflict that they see is inevitable. The federal government filling local police stations with high-tech weapons. And then above all, just a deadly spirit of hatred infusing the minds of growing numbers of people. It's a recipe for disaster. It really is a recipe for disaster. Can you recognize this? Can you see this? And will you respond? We all have to ask that question. And if we do, then God will give us the answers we'll need. He'll give us the comfort that we need. And he'll also give us the protection that we need. Thanks for listening, and I anticipate seeing you again fairly soon.